This is Encounter on VOA. Here's Carol Castillo.
Welcome to Encounter on the Voice of America. On this edition of the program, First Lady Melania Trump goes to Africa, and yet another South Sudan peace agreement. Can this one hold? Hello again, I'm Carol Castillo. First Lady of the United States Melania Trump is on her first major solo international trip since her husband became president. The White House says her five-day tour of four countries, Ghana, Malawi, Kenya, and Egypt, focus on maternal and newborn care in hospitals, education for children, the deep culture and history woven into each African country, and how the United States is supporting each country on its journey to self-reliance. Child welfare has been the focus of Trump's, quote, Be Best, unquote, campaign launched earlier this year. However, Melania's trip could be complicated by the actions and words of her husband, who has referred to Africa in vulgar terms. While Africa is a continent that many former first ladies, such as Michelle Obama, Hillary Clinton, and Laura Bush, have visited, Melania Trump's visit raises a few more concerns. And last month, Salva Kiir, the president of South Sudan and the former vice president and rebel leader Riek Machar, signed a peace agreement to end the brutal civil war. As this is the 12th agreement between them, many critics wonder if the new peace deal is any different from earlier ones and if it could last. Well, joining us to discuss the impact of First Lady Melania Trump's visit to the continent and South Sudan's new peace deal and much more are two distinguished regional analysts. J. Peter Pham is Vice President for Research and Regional Initiatives and Director of the Africa Center at the Atlantic Council, and that's a think tank based here in Washington, and Jennifer Cook. She's Director of the Institute for African Studies at the George Washington University here in Washington, and she's the former Director of the Africa Program at the Center for Strategic and International Studies. Well, both panelists join me here at the VOA Broadcast Center in Washington. Welcome back to the program.
Thank you, Carol.
Thanks, Carol.
Well, Peter, let me begin with you, and let's talk about the First Lady's trip to the continent. We recently heard President Trump speak at the UN General Assembly, again, sort of denouncing globalism, and that can't sit necessarily well with Africa or many other countries in the world. Nonetheless, to what extent do you think Melania's trip can somehow mitigate some of these statements and actions? How do you see her visit and its impact in Africa?
Well, actually, let me push back a little bit, Carol. The recent actions of the administration, especially the statements made by National Security Advisor John Bolton, as well as the president on the International Criminal Court, actually resonate with many African leaders, many of whom have for a number of years been criticizing the ICC. So, in fact, I met with a number of African heads of state and during the last week, and many of them actually were applauding an attaboy attitude towards the administration's stance on the ICC. So not everything that the president said, sovereignty issues, et cetera, went well with them. For the First Lady's visit, it's, as you mentioned, Carol, it's in line with other visits that previous First Ladies have done. Africa is a nice canvas on which American soft power plays very well, and First Ladies have that in great measure. As you mentioned, Michelle Obama visited Africa to highlight her priorities, which was education for girls. Laura Bush visited in her time, and if we go back earlier, Hillary Rodham Clinton used Africa to promote her domestic agenda as a canvas. So this is in line with that, and I think the reception we've seen has been largely enthusiastic for her. Her visits with her counterparts, the First Ladies, as well as her visits with especially hospitals and schools.
Jennifer Cook, turning to you, first of all, congratulations on your new position at George Washington University. It's great to have you back. I'd like to get your take now on the First Lady's visit to Africa. As we've said, in line with other First Ladies' visits, it's a goodwill visit. How do you see it and its impact on the continent?
I guess I differ with Peter a little bit. I think it's a good thing that she's going. She brings media with her, and more exposure to African challenges is always a good thing here in the United States. But her visit, unlike her predecessors, is not connected to any broader vision of American policy in Africa. You have statements, but the president has not really spoken at any length or in any detail about the U.S. relationship, publicly at least, with Africa. You don't see this connected to any kind of policy initiatives. We'll wait to see if on her return something comes of it. The bureaucracy of the State Department and USAID are continuing on with their jobs and in some cases doing very well, but it doesn't seem embedded in a bigger strategy and a bigger policy. And it's not clear that she has the ear of her husband or the administration on these kinds of things. Two things politically. I think to the president's base, I think Africa matters very little. And to his opponents, they're going to be very skeptical of the trip having much meaning. On the UN, I think the idea of kind of trying to deconstruct a number of these global governance institutions, they are designed to bring some kind of rule of law. The ICC is maybe a separate case, but to empower to some extent the weaker countries. Without kind of global governance, you have the strong doing what they can, the weak doing what they must. It's those international institutions that become a forum for finding common ground. And to, you know, his kind of denigration of the institution, the idea that we will give foreign assistance to countries that are nice to us, that's not really elevating kind of view of U.S. global leadership and its view of Africa and these countries that receive foreign assistance. So I think with such two divergent messages, one, yes, a nice opportunity to meet with children and mothers by the First Lady and a soft power touch, but it's so disconnected from the administration policies that I don't think it will have really lasting impact.
Turning back to you, Peter Pham, picking up on what Jennifer said about the trip being somehow disconnected to any broader vision of Africa from the United States, not connected to any real policy issues, notwithstanding your interesting statement with regard to some of the African leaders' view of the ICC, which converges with that of the United States, at least at this moment. Talk about the broader policy in practical terms. Are we, that is, the United States, providing more or less assistance in monetary terms or programmatic terms? How does that translate into exactly what the U.S. is or is not doing vis-a-vis the continent?
Again, I have to respectfully disagree with my friend Jennifer here. The administration actually, if you read the policy documents of the Trump administration, has articulated more on Africa in the policy documents than its predecessor did at the same time in history. The Obama administration didn't release an Africa strategy until 2012, as the president was running for re-election. In the Trump administration, instead, the first year, former Secretary Rex Tillerson convened African foreign ministers in November of his year in office. In December, the National Security Strategy of the United States, for the first time ever since that document was mandated by Congress from administrations, had in the National Security Strategy a separate, distinct section on Africa. And in fact, it was the second longest geographic section after the Indo-Pacific region. And then the National Defense Strategy, which came out in January of this year, had a section on Africa. So there's been articulated a strategy. Is it as detailed as someone like me, who has actually written a strategy proposal for the administration on Africa, would like? No, but there are elements there of a strategy. And as Jennifer said, with the professional foreign service, the State Department, Defense Department, USAID, and other agencies operating with what has been articulated, I would argue there is a policy. It may not be the policy to the liking of many people, but still a policy.
Are there resources to go with that policy?
So far, especially in foreign assistance to Africa, remain roughly the same. In fact, with in certain accounts actually increase. For example, the support for the G5 Sahel countries in the counterterrorism fight, there was actually new money thrown into that.
You get to respond, Jennifer, with respect to resources in particular, and then the emphasis that Peter said has been given, at least rhetorically, you know, to Africa.
Look, I'm skeptical of all national security strategies because they are kind of wish lists, or they can say a lot of good things. I think leadership matters in this regard. And as I say, there have been departments that have been going on, and Congress has been a staunch kind of defender of funding that goes to Africa and on development assistance. You know, you have Mark Green at the head of USAID, who is in, I think, difficult circumstances, doing a fantastic job. You have a new assistant secretary of state after almost 2 years into the administration. So it's not to denigrate the work that they're doing, but the president himself has not evinced any interest. In fact, any interest he's had has been largely negative. He's had a couple of state visits. But there's something more than a document policy to say where the U.S. stands on this. And there have been positive developments, but they're not necessarily emanating from the administration.
We'll have more in just a moment, but first you're listening to Encounter on the Voice of America. My guests are J. Peter Pham. He's Vice President for Research and Regional Initiatives and Director of the Africa Center at the Atlantic Council, and Jennifer Cook, from whom you just heard. She's now the Director of the Institute for African Studies at the George Washington University's Elliott School of International Affairs. We're discussing First Lady Melania Trump's solo trip to Africa, and soon we'll talk about the new South Sudan peace agreement. And this is a reminder that our Encounter podcast is available on our website at voanews.com/encounter and also for free download on iTunes. You may also follow us on Twitter at Carol Castiel VOA or connect with us on Facebook. Well, here's a big shout out to a loyal listener, Sunusi Yaro from Kafanchan in Kaduna State, Nigeria. Thanks so much for your email, Sunusi. If you want to hear your name on the air, please send an email to encounter@voanews.com or like us and leave a comment on our Facebook page. Well, back to you, Peter Pham. Let's move on now and talk about this new South Sudan peace deal, yet another one. Your organization, the Atlantic Council, recently hosted a roundtable featuring South Sudan's first vice president, Taban Dengai. What have we learned about this new deal? How different is it from previous ones, and what are the prospects for it holding?
Unfortunately, the skepticism that many analysts and experts have greeted this latest, as you say, the 12th peace agreement between Riek Machar, the former first vice president and rebel leader, and Salva Kiir, the president of South Sudan, I think is fully justified. And currently, the first vice president, although he's, according to this peace agreement, if it's ever implemented, he's going to lose that title. Taban Deng was in Washington this past week, and his visit did not reassure anyone. In fact, if anything, it underscored the problematic nature of all these accords. They're not real peace accords. There's no political will. They're, if you will, prophylaxis against getting sanctioned now by the international community. The United States has been very, very proactive during this administration, pushing first a unilateral and now a UN arms embargo on South Sudan. And there have been sanctions against leaders on both sides. And I think there's a movement towards sanctions at the very top. And so to avoid this, they sign a peace deal, but the implementation has not taken place. This was signed August 6th. We're now in October. Very little has been done. And in fact, multiplying government posts, they're going to have five vice presidents, doubling the size of parliament, even as a third of the country is either dead or displaced as refugees or IDPs, and two-thirds of the country is facing severe food insecurity. Rearranging the deck chairs on the Titanic isn't going to do it.
Jennifer Cook, a very dire situation, as Peter said, in South Sudan, and we don't know if this agreement is going to change anything.
I agree with Peter. Yeah, I think it's a very fragile deal. It's kind of a deal cut among the leadership of who gets paid what. I mean, it's really kind of a doling out of national resources with no guarantees of transparency or accountability on that. I mean, maybe the one difference is that Sudan and Uganda are guarantors of the agreement, and so that they have something of a reputational stake in making this work. And they are two very influential regional players. But everything that Peter says is true. Nothing genuinely has changed except for that in some ways. And you don't want to dismiss it out of hand, because every agreement provides at least an opening and a first step towards something that could be consolidated. But this doesn't seem that much different from the previous ones. A deal cut at the top, which is where the problem is not going to answer the challenges.
And what about, Peter, the role for Khartoum and Uganda? Will that perhaps make a difference as guarantors?
At the margins, but both countries are doing it for their own self-interest. By most estimates, a good fifth of the Ugandan economy is doing business with South Sudan, so it's bad for business. Khartoum would like to get the oil pumping again from South Sudan because they get paid transit fees for the oil. They're not making anything with no production. There's a growing rapprochement between Khartoum and Washington. And so Khartoum is being helpful. And it's rather ironic, actually, for all the years of fighting to break free from Sudan, that hundreds of thousands of South Sudanese have, when things got bad, fled to Sudan to get away from their leadership. And, you know, I would like to be hopeful, but I can't. And be realistic, this agreement is now 2 months old, yet even the most basic provisions, forget about the complex workings of cantonment and disarmament of fighters, even basic things, release of political prisoners, amnesty for those unlawfully detained or imprisoned for their views. None of that has happened. People have not been released, even coming back to be a part of the government. Riek Machar has cited security concerns. Last time they went through this exercise, those objections dragged out the implementation by a good 6-9 months over quibbling over how many guns and how many protection agents one can bring with one. So there's a lot to go. We hope there's a lasting peace, but this accord doesn't address the fundamental issues, as Jennifer said. It's the leadership that's the problem, and all this does is give them 3 more years in office. Elections were due in 2014. We're now in 2018, and we're looking at 2021.
Unbelievable. Well, back to you again, Jennifer, to talk about the ramifications or implications of this failing state for the continent, for the region. Obviously, it can't go on like this. What could break this impasse if you were to be asked to advise? And
that is a very tough one, because implications for the region, I mean, people have lived with a catastrophe already in Sudan, in South Sudan. You know, I do think, as Peter said, Sudan and Uganda have more than just reputational stakes. And you know, Museveni may be in a position to really put the squeeze on Salva Kiir, and likewise Bashir put the squeeze on Riek Machar. Maybe things that you're not going to write down on paper.
Exactly.
Because Sudan's economy depends on the oil pumping out. And as Peter said, Uganda depends heavily on the South Sudanese economy. And those self-interests, okay, may not be pretty, but they may come to some kind of an agreement backed by people who have a real stake and are not afraid to kind of bend the rules a little bit to enforce their interests.
Peter, what about the role of the United States, and what about even Beijing here? Because we know they're very invested, so to speak, in Africa in terms of security and economics, trade, investment. Any role for these two big superpowers?
Well, I think the United States has taken a leadership role in first cutting off, legally at least, the flow of arms, first through the unilateral embargo and then now the achievement of getting the UN Security Council to formally embargo awe arms. Unfortunately, the country is awash in arms, and it will take a while before there's true necessity for additional imports, unfortunately. But I think the U.S. has some opportunities ahead. One thing, sanctioning individuals. Many of the South Sudanese leaders, and I put leaders in quotation marks, have either assets in the United States or accounts, or they come and go here. Some of them even have family settled in the United States. So putting the squeeze on them right where it hurts, I think, may get some attention to. So I think targeted sanctions are necessary. I think the next step is going to be to reevaluate our relationship with South Sudan. Since the Comprehensive Peace Agreement in 2005, the United States has pumped $14 billion into South Sudan, most of it going to feed the South Sudanese people who are rendered, you know, refugees. 2.5 million of them are refugees in neighboring countries. 1.5 million are displaced in their own country. So a lot of it is in humanitarian assistance. But some of it has in the past gone to the government and in various programs. And last May, the Trump administration ordered the encouragement of U.S. Aid Administrator Ambassador Mark Green, whom Jennifer mentioned earlier, embarked on a comprehensive review of U.S. aid policy vis-a-vis South Sudan. I would make the argument that we need to expand the mandate of that policy review to include a broader view of our political relationship and whether we continue to recognize this government as the legitimate government. And a marker was put down by the administration actually in July in a White House statement where warning that this extension of terms for these people well into the future undermine their legitimacy. And, you know, that's a first marker, and I think there, you know, there are implications from that.
So, Jennifer, you talked about a role for Uganda and Sudan, but what about the United States? And Peter didn't mention China, but I don't know whether they have a role at all in a constructive way to broker something.
Yeah, I mean, I think the targeted sanctions thing is right on. And, yeah, many do have families or kids going to school here. It may seem cruel, but, I mean, it does get them where it matters. You know, and I think, yes, the sheen is off South Sudan. I think previous administrations had kind of an ideological attachment to the SPLM and a more pragmatic, kind of clear-eyed understanding of what is exactly is the nature of this government, I think is a change for the better. Yeah, I mean, I think conditioning assistance is something that wasn't done. You know, I mean, I think after the initial independence, there wasn't kind of a critical eye cast on where this money was going, how the government was performing. The South Sudanese government believed the U.S. had its back and it, whatever happened, and the U.S. was not really looking too carefully at it. So that massive amounts of money barely benefited the people of Sudan in some ways. So thinking much more, you know, strategically about how we use our aid in that kind of conflicted situation is important. China, I think if it engages, it will do so in a quiet way, and it's not going to try to make headlines as a peace broker, but it can play an influential role in incentivizing some of the players at stake. It too has an interest in peace, ultimately.
Well, as we close, Peter, let's turn to another peace agreement, for which perhaps there's more optimism, Ethiopia and Eritrea. There's been a lot of excitement about that, but how is it going, these two former adversaries but neighbors? How is the implementation of that agreement going?
Well, certain, if you will, low-cost things have been implemented. Direct flights between Asmara and Addis Ababa. The leaders have met, which is something that hadn't occurred in years. They've visited each other's capitals. So their telephone calls can be made from Ethiopia to Eritrea and back. So those are certainly solid gestures. They're confidence-building measures, and we hope they lead to something more. But on the big issues, the withdrawal of troops from the border, much less from the disputed territories, that hasn't occurred. The disarmament, the opening up of actual trade, promise, but those are the harder things. Now, those take time, so I don't think we should be impatient about it. But at the same time, that's going to be the real litmus test. And then we have a challenge. Is peace sustainable? From the Ethiopian side, I can see it being very sustainable. Eritrea is in a tough position, though. It's, in a way, carried on by the enthusiasm, the euphoria, as well as its diplomatic allies into this peace. But this is a country that has never had elections, doesn't even have a written constitution. It has unlimited national service, including military service. People are drafted for decades. And now how do you take this militarized state and, without an enemy to justify all this, an opening is going to create all sorts of waves for the incumbents in power, and whether they can ride it through, that's a different story.
The last word to you, Jennifer, on the Eritrea-Ethiopia peace agreement, the big impediments ahead. Are you optimistic that they can be overcome?
I think they can be overcome. I mean, one challenge is that the euphoria around the Ethiopian prime minister's, you know, success, you know, there are challengers within Ethiopia who may pull back some of the commitments that he's made, for example, on ideological grounds. I still remain optimistic about that. And it tells you what an individual leader can do in terms of transforming a situation that seems kind of ossified and embedded. So, you know, last time we were here, I was very skeptical and Peter was more optimistic. And Peter, I'm happy to say, was right. And, you know, things could happen in Eritrea. I mean, it's a model that other leaders might look at as well and say, you know, you can rule through absolute totalitarian control, or you can open up and, you know, the surge of popularity that he enjoys. You know, if they open up economic relations, kind of the port and so forth, there's a big opportunity on the horizon for Eritrea if their leaders can kind of look a little bit beyond the end of their nose.
All right. Well, on that relatively optimistic note, I'm afraid that's all the time we have on this edition of Encounter. I'd like to thank my guest, J. Peter Pham. He's Vice President for Research and Regional Initiatives and Director of the Africa Center at the Atlantic Council, and Jennifer Cook, Director of the Institute for African Studies at the George Washington University. Thanks so much to both of you for your terrific insights.
Thank you, Carol.
Encounter was produced in Washington. Our engineer was Glenn Hollis. I'm Carol Castiel. Join me again next week for another Encounter on the Voice of America.